I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Great white sharks have always been found in the waters off southeastern Massachusetts, but in the last decade, sightings have increased significantly. In a few minutes, we discuss a public safety and education collaboration between shark scientists, town officials, and the Cape Cod Seashore. But first, why are we seeing such a significant increase in the numbers of sharks, and what kinds of information are researchers gathering about the species? We welcome back to the program Greg Skomel, Senior Marine Fisheries Scientist at the Massachusetts Department of Marine Fisheries. Great to see you again.
Oh, it's good to be back, Mindy.
So your research of great white sharks off Cape Cod began back in 2004 when you got a call about a shark in the shallow waters off Nashan Island. So what were your first thoughts when you received that call?
Well, I've got to be honest with you. I didn't think it was a white shark. You know, we have, over the many years that I've been doing this job, and back in 2004, we had not seen many white sharks at all. And that phone call from a friend of mine saying that he had a report of a white shark in a small salt pond on Nashan Island, I was thinking, no, this can't be real. And then
it's
when
probably
I actually
a basking shark.
Yeah,
right?
I thought it might be a basking shark, an ocean sunfish, a stranded harbor porpoise, anything but a white shark. And when I got there, you know, the next morning, and saw it was a white shark, I was literally, it was just so amazing to me. It was the beginning.
So you identified it as a white shark. Mm-hmm. You realized this would be a once-in-a-lifetime research opportunity, and at the same time, a huge national story. I mean, this thing got, there were people flooding down here in Woods Hole trying to get over to see that shark.
It was overwhelming. It was unbelievable. Woods Hole was jam-packed because people wanted to see that white shark. And what I found most fascinating about that experience is it was quite opposite than what I expected. I figured people would say, we've got this big, dangerous animal in an area where it can pose a threat. Let's kill it. Let's get rid of it. And 50 years ago, that probably would have happened. But the reaction from the public was quite opposite. People were emailing me, phone calls, you name it, inundating me with all kinds of pleas to save the shark. And it took a couple of weeks, but we did get the shark out.
What did you learn from that experience with that shark?
Well, I laugh a little bit about it. Back then, it's bittersweet because I put a very sophisticated tag in that shark within a couple of hours of meeting it, and then the shark stayed for 2 weeks in that pond, and it took a while for us to get it out. We finally got it out, and I figured at that moment I was going to learn remarkable information from this tag, and the tag malfunctioned. It came off early, and all I learned is that shark was trapped in a salt pond for 2 weeks.
When did we begin to see this regular and marked increase in the number of white sharks in our waters?
It really does begin back in 2004. My assistant, John Chisholm, and I, working for the agency, were tabulating information about the presence of seals, the growing population of seals, and more importantly, injured and bitten seals, particularly on the eastern shore of Cape Cod. And that started to increase quite rapidly. We didn't have a lot of sightings, and weren't actually seeing a lot of white sharks, but we had a lot of indirect evidence with these carcasses on the beach saying something's out here eating them, something's biting them. And then as the decade progressed, we realized the numbers were going up, and people were reporting to us, we're seeing what looks like white sharks. And of course, we always think, it could be a basking shark, it could be any of the other species. But no, it turned out that these were white sharks, and then things really kicked off in 2009 when one of the spotter pilots, George Breen, that we were working with, spotted two of them off of Chatham, and then everything started.
So is it the increase in the seal population that's bringing the white sharks?
Yeah, I truly believe it is. When we look at it, it's a very simple correlation, but let's face it, you establish a robust population of a prey item and you're going to get some kind of predator. In the case of seals, that predator is white sharks. And we can look historically around the world where we see increases in seal populations and regional abundance of seals go up. We're going to see white sharks drawn to that area, and that's exactly what's happening here.
40 years ago, seals were hunted almost to extinction, but became a federally protected species in 1972 under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. So since then, we've seen the numbers of the seals rise. Is there any anecdotal evidence that when we had this healthy seal population, say 60, 70 years ago, that there were likely more white sharks in our waters at that time as well?
It's entirely plausible, but we don't have any good records of it. One of the things we did with the colleagues a couple of years ago is we looked at all these sightings data sets going back to as far as the 1800s to see whether or not white shark populations are changing along the eastern seaboard of the United States. And what we were able to conclude is that the white shark population took a pretty big hit in the 70s and 80s, not only as a result of the movie Jaws, but also because we saw a massive expansion in commercial fishing targeting sharks. And so the white shark population took a hit, and then with protection that came in place through the federal government and then followed up by Massachusetts, in the late 90s, we've seen a rebounding population. And that's the general East Coast population. So that's a good sign. But we don't have a lot of good indicators on what the seals have been doing. And if you talk to any of the Cape Cod old timers, they'll tell you even as kids, they never saw a lot of seals. And that's because we did a lot of damage to these seal populations, you know, literally hundreds over the last couple of hundred years.
What is not known about white sharks, particularly those found in New England waters, is much greater than what is known. And before you started your tagging research, we knew even less. So when you first started studying the white sharks off the coast, what was known about the species then?
When we first started the work, putting the sophisticated tagging technology on, we had a general sense of its distribution just based on all these historical sightings records, these catch records. And so we had a sense of where this animal was distributed. We had some tissue samples from a number of sharks that have been brought in over the last couple of decades, and that allowed us to kind of piece together some of the natural history of the animal. So, for example, by saving backbones from white sharks, we've been able to get estimates of age because, like trees, rings in the backbones give you a sense of the age of the animals. So some of that tissue sampling gave us a sense of what some of the natural history of the animal was, but we had no idea about the behavior over multiple scales. What are they doing from day to day? What are they doing from year to year? Where are they going? You know, how do they live in this part of the world? We just knew nothing about that.
So these are the questions that you set out to answer as you've been tagging these sharks. I think it's interesting because you've had lots of surprises. I remember there was a shark, I think it was in December, where the water was cold and you thought, I didn't think they'd be here at this time. So you're learning a lot about them now. So tell us some of the questions that you have been able to answer.
Well, first and foremost for us, we wanted to start to fill in some of the behavioral information that we were lacking. You know, what do these animals do? Some of the ecology of the animal. And so we started with the sophisticated tagging techniques to get a sense of not only where they go around the Cape and Massachusetts waters, where are they spending their time, but also what happens when they leave here. And I tell you, it's been a curveball after curveball, because every time I think I've figured out some kind of pattern when it comes to white sharks, there's an individual white shark that'll change, do something very different. You know, but we do see patterns emerge over time. And I think we have to think at different scales when we talk about this iconic animal, because it, you know, we're always trying to pigeonhole it into some kind of behavioral pattern. And that doesn't always happen with animals. And I'm finding that out with white sharks.
So why is tagging the best way to study this species? And describe what the tagging process entails and the costs that are associated with it.
Well, tagging gives us, because of the new technologies that are out there, they give us a real glimpse into how these animals live over much broader scales. In other words, when they leave Cape Cod, where are they going and do they come back? You know, not only where are they going, but how do they spend their time in three-dimensional space of the ocean? Are they diving deep? You know, those kinds of behavioral observations are important as to delineating not only, you know, the general migratory patterns, but also what are the habitat requirements of these animals? Because we live in a day and age where we really need to protect habitat for every creature that's living in the ocean. And so we're collecting those kinds of data sets. And our tagging technique is fairly straightforward. It's a little unorthodox in the sense that we're not trying to draw the sharks to our vessel like most researchers do. What we physically go after the sharks. So working with the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy, who's been a great partner for us in terms of funding and providing us platforms for research, we use a spotter pilot, Wayne Davis, to locate sharks off the eastern shore of Cape Cod. We then go toward those vessels on a small those sharks on a small vessel. And once we're close, we document who that shark is. We videotape it, and then we put a tag in it while it's free swimming along. Mm-hmm. And then that shark hopefully will reveal new secrets about the species.
So, what information do you receive from the tags, and how often do you receive that data?
Well, it really depends on the tag type. One of the tags we're using is a long-term 10-year tag. And all that tag does, it's called an acoustic tag, and all it does, as the name implies, is release a very, very high-pitched acoustic ping every couple of minutes. And working with towns like Orleans and Chatham and a number of others all over Massachusetts, we've been setting up an acoustic array of receivers. So anytime that those sharks swim within a couple of hundred meters of those receivers, it picks, detects the tag, decodes it, and does a timestamp. We then upload the data from the receivers, and we recreate the movements of that animal around Massachusetts. And so that gives us a really neat look at the fine scale movements, residency, fidelity to various sites around Massachusetts. And I think that really opens the eyes to a lot of beach managers and folks who are in charge of public safety, because they're interested in where the sharks mm-hmm. are spending time. And so a lot depends on where we put the receivers, and we're working with all the towns around Massachusetts to get as many as we can out. We have over 100 out right now. Another kind of tag we're using is a satellite-based technology, and there's two different models for that. One of them is just a data logger. It collects temperature information, depth information, logs those data, and then at a time programmed by us, will release from the shark, float to the surface, transmit those data to a satellite. We'll then recreate the three-dimensional movements of the shark after the fact. So that's not a real-time telemetry tag. And then a last kind of tag we use is a real-time satellite tag. And that's one that, when the shark is at the surface, transmits to a satellite. And we can follow its movements in real time, as long as that shark comes to the surface. So every tag has its strengths and weaknesses, and by combining all three technologies, we get a better, more comprehensive look at the behavior of the animal.
Is the cost very different between the types of tags?
Oh, very much so, very much so. The acoustic tag is about a $400 tag, and the more sophisticated satellite tags can be over $4,000.
Wow, that's a lot of money here. You mentioned the acoustic ones that make this ping. Does that interfere with the shark at all, hearing that ping all the time?
It's a great question, but it does not. It's a very, very high frequency tag, so the shark, we can't even hear it. So it's beyond the hearing range of the shark.
So you're in the midst of a 5-year study right now, right? Tell us the focus of the study.
Yeah, I've described the movement ecology study, which is where these animals are going, and the other study, again, with a lot of support for the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy, is to try to get an assessment of the population size of white sharks around Massachusetts. And I think it's a big question, not only for us as researchers and looking at the conservation of the species and the natural history, the ecology, the biology of it, but also from a public safety perspective. I think a lot of towns are super interested in that number. Mm-hmm. And I say this a lot, but if I tell a town that there's, 50 white sharks that visit this area every year, they think one thing. And if I tell them 5,000, they think something else. Mm-hmm. So I think being able to pin down that number is important for a number of different reasons.
You mentioned your partnership with Atlantic White Shark Conservancy, and you've come up with a Sharktivity map and app. So what are those tools designed to do?
What's really cool about the Sharktivity app is it allows folks to exchange information and to see where white sharks are around our coastal waters and beyond. The Sharktivity app is applicable almost anywhere. But it allows the general public and folks interested in these sharks, but also curious about, where they spend their time, to see where the latest sightings are coming from. So most of our tag data will go up on the Sharktivity app as quickly as possible. And we're out there as well, twice a week doing our research. So as we see sharks, we'll get them up on the Sharktivity app so folks can get a sense of where these animals are. And I think the towns which are participating in this also want to know where they are. Mm-hmm. So if somebody sites something off the national seashore, we get that up there as quickly as possible. We think that reaching out to the public, being proactive, educating the public about where these animals are and what they're doing is the way to move forward.
Anybody who's stopped by into the Hui Visitors Center has seen the Shark Cam. It's a submersible equipped cameras that follows a shark tagged with a special tracking device, a way of gathering the data and what the sharks are doing below the surface, again, which we don't know a lot about. So what information could this kind of tracking camera give us, and what are some of the limits on how the Shark Cam can be used?
Well, I'm hoping the sky is the limit somewhere down the road. We're not there yet, But whenever you use new technologies, you take these baby steps. And we've done some great stuff working with the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, Oceanographic Systems Laboratory here, using the REMUS AUV technology. My ultimate goal, our ultimate goal, really is to open, get observations of these animals when they disappear from our sight. You know, we're all too often looking at television and we see these sharks at the surface jumping out of the water. We're so, you know, used to seeing these behaviors. The truth is that they spend the bulk of their time below the surface in deep water. And the real curiosity factor for us is, what are they doing when they're out of sight from us? And the shark cam has already opened new doors and revealed secrets about their lives when they leave us. The ultimate goal, of course, is to follow a shark over longer periods of time. And we're not there yet, but we have been incrementally increasing it. So the big limitation now for us is power, battery power. And we're limited to maybe a day, maybe less. But at some point, we'd like to get it up to days or weeks where we can really get a sense of what these animals are doing when they're out of sight.
Yeah, and I suppose, you know, at some point, we might have these cameras that could give you constant images, right, where we could see, which would be helpful not only in shark research, but say, you know, sea turtles or other animals as well, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we call it Shark Cam. It's kind of a funny, it's a great name. People remember it. But the bottom line is it's a any marine animal camera.
Yeah. If someone Googles Shark Tracker, the organization OSearch pops up with an extensive global map of tagged sharks. How does their research differ from yours? You mentioned that some researchers actually, you know, bring, like, get the animals to come to the ship, I imagine, with some chum or something like that, right?
Right, right. You know, the OSearch operation has been instrumental in assisting scientists. I think, admittedly, they'll tell you they don't do any active research themselves. They're not scientists. They're well-trained fish handlers and fishermen. And they provide an incredible platform for researchers to hop on, work on the species that they're interested in. And mostly it's white sharks. And so OSearch has gone around the world assisting white shark researchers. They worked with us in 2012 and 13 off the coast of Massachusetts. We've tagged four sharks with the technology, the real-time satellite technology. So they do provide this, not only the platform for researchers, but they also have this website that allows, you know, the average person and scientists as well, you know, to observe what the animals are doing in real time.
Yeah. We're talking about great white sharks with Greg Skomel, senior marine fisheries scientist at the Massachusetts Department of Marine Fisheries. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about great white sharks with Greg Skomel, senior marine fisheries scientist at the Massachusetts Department of Marine Fisheries. And, you know, joining us now to talk about how Cape Town's officials from the National Seashore and scientists are working together to craft a public safety and education campaign is Nathan Sears. He's natural resources manager for the town of Orleans. He joins us on the phone. Good morning, Nathan.
Good morning, Mindy.
So
morning,
there's a lot of excitement and hype about white sharks in our waters, but also a lot of concern when we look at this from a public safety standpoint. So tell us more about the Shark Working Group. Who's involved in and what's your mission?
Well, the Regional Shark Working Group is comprised of Massachusetts coastal towns, the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy, Dr. Skomel, the National Seashore. We get together on a regular basis, talk about the new reality of the amount of activity of white sharks off our coastal beaches, the amount of activity within the swim areas, and really to come up with a game plan that so that we're all consistent and on the same page about how to manage these beaches so that we can provide a safe opportunity for people to visit the beach and recreate.
Yeah, there's been some concern early on that we should be careful not to scare away tourists from Cape beaches because it could have a detrimental impact on our seasonal economy. But that's kind of changed. People are you know, were you surprised, Greg, when you all these people started coming down to say, I want to see the sharks?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Originally, we thought, I think all of us thought, that these sharks would scare people away. But, I mean, the first town to embrace these animals was the town of Chatham, where we were tagging most of our fish. And people were flocking to Chatham, and now they're flocking to other Cape towns to see white sharks, to immerse themselves in the whole white shark experience. I'm pleasantly surprised by that.
Yeah. Nathan, were you surprised?
I was. It really has promoted a whole new type of tourism. We certainly aren't seeing less people visiting our beaches, and there is a hype that goes on down at the beaches during the busy time of year where people are really eager to witness a shark.
Mm-hmm. So how have the beach policies and procedures changed over the past few years, both in response to the growing number of sharks and also what we're learning from Greg's research?
Well, I can't give kudos enough to Dr. Skolmel in the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy. Without their research, we would have a very poor handle on the situation that we're in. Having the spotter planes up a couple days of the week and the education that they're providing to us pretty much provides the backbone for the public awareness campaign that the town has implemented. 2 days a week, we have a spotter plane up on a regular basis. It's being relayed back to us that there are up to a half dozen sharks in a day within the swim areas off Nauset Beach. And so it came very clear to us. It wasn't the 2 days a week that the spotter planes were up. It was 7 days a week that this was happening. And it became very clear that we can't rely solely on staff on the shore to locate the sharks. Mm-hmm. So in order for the people that are visiting the beaches to have an understanding of, the reality of the amount of activity in the swim areas, it's key for us to provide signage at the beach with eye-catching graphics that brings the people in. Like we talked about, it promotes the tourism based on the sharks, but it also starts that conversation so that people can make conscious decisions on their own about how they choose to recreate.
Yeah. Lifeguards will be in charge of enforcing policies and procedures as well as being the first responders if there is an interaction between sharks and humans. So how have you prepared lifeguards for these new responsibilities, and how do you ensure you have the right people for the job?
We certainly have a tremendous amount of training that goes along with it. We have EMTs on the beach now that work through the beach managers as well as the fire department. We train our staff to be able to treat wounds that would be consistent with a shark bite. And we are in a unique situation because not only do we have a public beach in the town of Orleans, but we have remote stretches of coastline on the barrier beaches that people drive off-road vehicles to. So we provide EMTs on those remote stretches just in case there was ever a negative interaction with one of these animals.
And I think there are a lot of people say that it's an inevitable at some point we will have an interaction as these numbers grow and, we have the people in the water. And I think it's interesting, too, with the tracker where we can see, where people look at, they go, oh, look, okay, this shark's over here. But we got to remember, not every shark is tagged, right? So you can't really be sure that the water is no, there's no sharks there.
Absolutely. The last thing that we want to do is provide a false sense of security to people that are visiting the beaches. The idea is to fly dangerous marine life flags every day that we have the beaches open and we have lifeguards on the beach. Like I said, it's not just the days that we're able to spot them with planes that the sharks are in the swim mm-hmm. areas. So it was a decision that was made in the shark working group that we fly these flags daily. It starts that conversation. It needs to be up to every single person that visits the beach on whether, the type of safety measures that they're going to take.
So what are basic rules of thumb for humans that plan on being in the waters where great white sharks have been seen? And Greg, do we know anything about, as you're watching how they travel, as a shark travels through a particular area, are they likely to come back? Do we know?
Yeah, they are likely to come back, not only on a seasonal basis, but there's some sharks that have these periods of residency in specific areas. And one of the things we've done the last couple of years is amass a couple of really good acoustic data sets using the tags I mentioned earlier. And now we're looking at those. Now that we've got robust data sets, we can model them relative to various environmental factors. So time of day, tide, depth, water temperature. And we're hoping that in the coming months, we'll have some results from those models. So we'll be able to actually give you a sense, give beach managers like Nate a sense of, all right, this is your riskiest times of when sharks are going to be in these near shore habitats. And that's the ultimate goal of our movement ecology work using acoustic technology, to try to provide beach managers with more information.
And do we know when they generally are feeding our sharks? Could it be any time of the day, or is it generally, dusk, dawn?
Well, the old saying was they feed at dusk and dawn. And there are species, it's been demonstrably shown in some species through research, that they do feed then. In the case of the white shark, not so much. You know, they're highly visual predators, so we assume they're feeding throughout the day. We know we see a lot of them in shallow water, hunting patterns, doing it during the day. And remarkably, we don't see a lot of natural predation events. Lots of seals, lots of sharks, but not a lot of interactions. Mm-hmm. We're trying to sort through that. What does that mean?
Yeah. So let's say a shark has had its meal. It's feasted on a seal. How long does that last? I mean, are they feeding? Are they going to be hungry the next day, or do we know?
Well, there's modeling, and then there's reality. Sometimes the models tell us that a white shark that's had a full belly of seal could potentially, you know, be fine, not eat again for 2 weeks to a month, depending on the study. But we also know that fish are opportunistic, and they'll set up in an area where there's multiple opportunities, and they'll feed often, regardless of whether or not they have to energetically. Mm. We think white sharks, particularly the residents that are coming close to shore around Cape Cod, are here for the purpose of bulking up through the season before leaving.
Yeah. So Nate, what do you tell beachgoers? I just heard Greg said sometimes they're found in shallow water. So what are some of the basic rules of thumb for people who are using the beaches?
I try to tell people not to go any deeper than their waist. If they're able to actually swim on a sandbar, to choose a sandbar where the visibility is great when the sun's overhead so that you can see for a great distance in waist-deep water. Avoid areas where the seals are on the sandbars, and avoid dawn and dusk.
Mm. Now, if you're swimming and you see a seal in the waters near you, is that cause for concern, or is it a more risk where there are large groups of seals?
I guess that would be a question for Greg, but, you know, the reality is there are so many seals along our coastline that, there's no way to avoid an encounter with a seal. We're seeing them, you know, it's a rare occasion where you aren't entering the water where there aren't seals.
Sure. No, I would back up exactly what Nate's saying. It's, you know, we can recommend don't swim near seals, but it's almost impossible in certain parts of the Cape Cod. And, you know, I think that what we're seeing is that the sharks will try to put themselves in areas that have predictable concentrations of seals to maximize the opportunity of feeding. So that tends to be near inlets where seals are coming and going from, for example, Chatham Harbor or those areas. And so you want to try to just, you know, be precautionary. You mm-hmm. know, I'm not saying a single seal in the area is going to be a high risk probability, but you don't want to go out 200 yards from the beach and water over your head, even in those situations.
Yeah. And seals are really curious. I'm just thinking back, we were birding on Monomoy, and there was a couple of seals in front of us. And after a few minutes, there was, you know, loads of them kind of curious, like looking at us as we're looking at them. So they're yeah. very curious, aren't they?
They're very curious, and they can be very sociable. So, you know, we talk to a lot of surfers all the time and say this, you know, we're trying to avoid the seals, but they're coming up to us. And
right.
I say, yeah, I don't know what you could do about that.
Are paddle boarders and kayakers at the same risk as swimmers? And do you recommend they do that as in groups rather than alone?
Well, I think if we look at statistics around the world, and that's really all we have to go on, we know that the surfers can be a high risk if we look at hot spots where white sharks and humans interact in large numbers, like, for example, the coast of California. So surfers tend to be a high risk group, as do divers. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, surfers are going to be bitten or divers are going to be bitten, but we, you know, the statistics show that. We didn't think that there were many kayak attacks or the probability of kayaks being attacked or windsurfers, but we had the incident in 2014 off of Plymouth where mm-hmm. two kayakers were struck by a white shark with great force. Fortunately, they weren't hurt, but that was clearly a predatory event. And so I would say that when you're in these zones with high seal concentrations where we're seeing large numbers of white sharks, you know, be careful.
Mm. We know there's a concentration of the white sharks along the east-facing beaches, but do we know if we are seeing them in Cape Cod Bay, Buzzards Bay, or the waters of Vineyard and Nantucket Sound?
Well, you know, thanks to funding from the Commonwealth through the Secretariat's office, we were able to expand our acoustic receiver array to include off Cape areas, you know, not only Cape Cod Bay, and we're working closely with the town of Barnstable, but up to, you know, Plymouth, Duxbury, Scituate, you know, as far north as even the Merrimack. And so, and we're also expanding to the south. And those data are coming in now as we collect our receivers. And we're trying to get a relative sense of the numbers of sharks, at least our tagged sharks, which are now over 100. How often are they going to these other parts that we weren't paying a lot of attention to? So we're working closely with those towns as well. And based on 2015 data, we know they go there. Not frequently, but they do go to almost every receiver we've put out.
Oh, wow. And we now have resident sharks? Do we have some that are staying year-round?
No, and I say residency, I mean that through the season.
The season,
there's
okay.
still a seasonal presence to them. There's a seasonality to their movements. All of our tagged sharks, at least, have left the area at the conclusion of the season, and the season could extend as late as mid-December, with them coming back again as early as late May. But we have this definite seasonality, although, as I said earlier, every time we put a tag out, there's some shark that's going to, you know, change that, and we have seen sharks move to the north of us in the wintertime, which is really what we don't expect.
Yeah. In reality, we are not on the menu for great whites, but there was a man bitten by a white shark in the summer of 2012 off of Truro. Thankfully, his injuries were not life-threatening, but what prompts someone getting bitten by a shark, and what is the likelihood? I mean, they're mistaking us for a seal, right? They're not going, oh, there's a tasty person.
Yeah, they're mistaking us, but it's a terrible thing. Nobody wants to be mistaken as a prey item, And in this case also, there's a level of curiosity with the shark. The individual who was struck was well off the beach, at least 100 yards off the beach, swimming with another person at the surface, making some noise at the surface. There were seals in the area. It drew the attention of the shark, but the way that the individual was bitten was not an aggressive strike that we clearly saw in the case of the kayaks. This was more of a what we call a test bite, and nobody wants a test bite either, but it caused severe injuries to the legs of the individual, but fortunately it was not life-threatening. But even a test bite could be a bad situation.
So if you're in the water and you see a shark near you, what do you do?
Well, you know, you move away. You try not to panic. You move away. Steadily as you can, keep your eyes on the shark if possible. Don't splash. Don't make a lot of motion. Just move slowly, methodically back to the beach.
And if you're in waist-deep water, that's easy to do. But if you're over your head, maybe not so much. You hear stories of like, oh, you're supposed to punch them if they come at you. I mean, is that...
Yeah, ever since I was a kid, you know, you hear you punch the nose of the shark. And I think that it probably comes from the simple fact that if you are indeed bitten or in very, very close proximity of to the shark and it is getting into, you know, your personal space or it's dangerously close, then you would strike the shark anywhere, you know, anywhere. And typically if the shark's coming at you, the first thing you're going to hit is its nose.
Right. In January, Dr. Allison Clark, lead scientist for the Shark Spotter Program, Cape Town, South Africa, gave a presentation to the Shark Working Group. And this is a region of the world that has had dealt with shark-human interaction for a number of years. Nate, what did you take away from her presentation?
Really, what I took from that was that there is no silver bullet in terms of keeping our beaches safe. And really, unfortunately, the message isn't, you know, sent home until there is a negative interaction with a white shark, and there's a tipping point there where changes are dramatically made on how people use and recreate the beach at the beaches.
I imagine there have been many suggestions on ways to better protect swimmers and recreators from sharks, everything from using the spotter planes to drones. And I would like to hear both of you, Greg, start with you, your thoughts on different ideas and how we protect swimmers.
Well, you know, agreeing with Nate and Allison's work overseas as other researchers around the world, there is no solution, one solution that's going to work. And every area is very different. Even where Allison is, they change their methods to some degree because of the changes in the environment between different beaches. I mean, new technologies are emerging, and some of them have promise. None of them really have been tested in a way that's going to demonstrate whether or not they're effective or not. I mean, a lot of it is just not feasible from an economic point of view or from an environmental point of view. You know, they use nets off of Australia and South Africa, but those are not feasible off our beaches because of the dynamic nature of the eastern shore of Cape Cod. Putting a spotter pilot in the air every day is a massive cost, and the spotter pilot can't be everywhere. Drone technology is perhaps not where it needs to be in terms of battery power and such. There's new balloon technology that can be tested, and that certainly should be explored. That's something that you could park an inflatable balloon up above a beach and perhaps view down and see what's happening. But there are these technologies that they still need to be explored, but we have to realize there is no silver bullet. Mm. And the more people know about these sharks, the better off they're going to be.
Nate, you want to add anything to that?
Sure. I mean, as we look forward, I look forward to exploring the new technology, but at this point, there is nothing that 100% eliminates the risk. So the idea is that we face the new reality and we educate the public. That's the first step.
Mm-hmm. So, Nate, as someone tasked with public education and public safety, what kinds of questions about shark behavior and activity do you still hope that will come out of Greg's research? What kind of answers?
Well, the big one that has come out of it so far is the seasonal times of year that the highest risk for interaction with these white sharks is, so that we understand, you know, there is times of years when there's less likely to be sharks in the swim areas, you know, earlier in the spring, that type of thing. But as we get a better handle on the population, I think it's key for us to understand the fact that how many sharks are coming and when to expect them.
And it's only February. You both are probably gearing up for a busy season. Greg, from a research perspective, what are your goals for this season?
Well, we're in the fourth year of our five-year population study, so I'm really excited about that. And that'll continue in our survey style, going from basically mid-June through October, surveying sharks and tagging them. We're going to get our acoustic receivers back out again in May. And we'd love to expand to towns that do not have them yet. Please reach out to us or the Conservancy, the Division of Marine Fisheries, or the White Shark Conservancy if you're interested. If there are towns out there who do want receivers, we're happy to provide them, work with them to get them out. Our relationship with Orleans is the kind of relationship we'd like to have with every coastal town in Massachusetts. And we'd like to continue with that. But, you know, right now we're putting forth our research plan in terms of the population work and the continued tagging. We've formed partnerships with Canada. They're interested in white sharks as well. So we have a number of collaborations that we're fostering. So we're pretty excited. But I'll be honest with you, I'm kind of happy to be in my office in February, you know, getting some of the paperwork done.
And Nate, from a safety public education perspective, what are your goals for the season?
To continue the public awareness and to educate the beachgoers. And I want to encourage people that visit our beaches to engage my staff in the conversation about the sharks so that everybody can be educated and can use the water safely.
Yeah. We'll have links with more information about Greg Skomel's research on white sharks as well as safety information created by the Shark Working Group at our website, capeandislands.org. Greg Skomel and Nathan Sears, thank you both for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Mindy. Great to be here.
Thank you.